Today on the LA Food Podcast, I'm your host Lucas Servodio, and you know that meme going around of Travis Kelce yelling into Andy Reid's ear? Well, that's exactly what Father Saul does to me when he doesn't like how I stack the segments on the pod. Andy Reid, I feel your pain. Speaking of folks at the top of their game, though, joining us today on the podcast are Courtney Kaplan and Charles Namba, the duo behind Echo Park's Tsubaki and Ototo, as well as the upcoming project Camellia in the Arts District. Both Tsubaki and Ototo have been making serious noise for years in Los Angeles and beyond. Their modern California-centric approach to the classic izakaya experience has been widely lauded and recognized by the likes of the LA Times, the James Beard Awards, and many, many more. Charles and Courtney walk us through the respective paths that led to their fateful meet cute at N Japanese Brasserie in New York City, and how they went from being colleagues in the New York restaurant scene to partners in life and business. We talk the ins and outs of sake, the inspirations behind Charles's menu items, and the unlikely media hit that launched Tsubaki into an entire new stratosphere of success. If you're the kind of person who's always been sake curious but never knew where to start, if you're a lover of all things Japan, or if you're just a fan of folks working hard to make their dreams come true, then you're gonna love this episode, dear listener. So, without further ado, let's chow down. Joining us today for a very special episode of the LA Food Podcast are Courtney Kaplan and Charles Namba, the masterminds behind Tsubaki and Ototo in Echo Park, as well as the upcoming Arts District project Camellia. Courtney, Charles, how are you doing today?
Hi, thank you so much for having us here.
Thanks for joining us. Where are you guys calling us from?
We are in rainy Highland Park this morning.
Oh my God, so am I. No way. We could have done this in person.
Yeah.
Are those your LA stomping grounds?
Yeah, that's where we live. Yeah.
Nice. We lived here for like the last 3 years. Absolutely love it. Can't imagine living anywhere else. What are your favorite places to eat in the neighborhood?
We're pretty close to Eagle Rock, so we go to Milk Farm and Eagle Rock quite a bit to get like a cheese plate or to do some shopping. There's Amiga Amore just opened. That Mexican Italian restaurant is really great. Oh, yeah.
The omelet place, the breakfast place.
There's a breakfast spot on all the way down on New York, close to Occidental. Delilah's. Think it's called, where we go for breakfast.
Delilah's.
Yeah.
Yeah, really good.
Yeah. Oh, that place's breakfast burritos, low-key underrated, and it's always packed too. You get there's like a little bit of a wait there on the weekends.
Yeah. Crazy.
Charles, you grew up in LA, is that right? Whereabouts did you grow up?
I grew up in Beverly Hills. Yeah, I went to Horace Mann, and then I went to Beverly High after that.
That's awesome. And I understand that your mom was tangentially involved in the food world, is that right?
When she was trying to sell dumplings, homemade dumplings, to Japanese restaurants around Los Angeles, and somehow she got a pilot to make Japanese dishes. So like 10 episodes, 10 dishes. It was sponsored by Ajinomoto, which is MSG, Japanese MSG. And that's her food career. That's how far she got.
Hey, that's awesome. If that was my food career, 10 episodes of a show, I'd be pretty happy with that person. Were you into food at this point, or were you kind of like, mom, stop doing that, that's embarrassing?
I wasn't into food until I got my first restaurant job. You know, I didn't even want to cook. So I really fell into it.
What was that first restaurant job?
It was in New York. It was a Japanese brasserie, they called it.
So I got a little bit of a bone to pick with you, because I read that you actually had a job before that at Mulberry Pizza. Is that right?
I cooked in high school. I worked there at Mulberry Street for maybe like 3 years.
And that didn't give you the bug of, I want to do this for the rest of my life?
No, but I think I was used to that, you know, as a first professional kitchen. Like, I worked in a smaller size kitchen. You know, I know just making like two salads, but it prepared me for it. So
yeah, still a classic. Courtney, how about you? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in New York. I'm from Long Island originally, and then spent my young adulthood in the city in New York.
Nice. So we got a bicoastal family here. And what was Courtney like as a kid? Were you into food?
Not really. I was super picky. I was became a vegetarian at the age of 11. So there was very little for me to eat. I was quite particular, I would say. So no, not into food at all. It was just kind of something I had to do was to eat. I didn't really have a strong passion for it growing up.
Are you still a vegetarian?
I'm a pescatarian, which I don't always share, but yeah, so I started eating fish, you know, after spending a lot of time in Japan. There's dashi and fish stock and everything. And I did grow up eating, when I was very young, eating a lot of seafood on Long Island. We have a lot of great oysters and clams and shellfish. So it was something I always enjoyed. So I did start eating that again, but I still don't eat meat.
Yeah.
So sake pairing sometimes are going on intuition if I'm not tasting everything that's on the plate.
I mean, so much of it is science, right? And flavor profiles, like you can still know that without tasting it.
Yeah, I think experience and talking about the dish and tasting, you know, around it, tasting sauces and, you know, understanding the building blocks helps. But yeah. I don't share that with every guest who comes through the door.
Yeah, for sure. Well, hopefully nobody listens to this then. I'll tell you what, my wife actually was a vegetarian for 15 years as well. And she transitioned into pescatarianism when we started dating. Mm-hmm. And just for the last 3 months, she started eating meat again. And has been a wild journey. Just like the last 3 months, It's like every time we go to Whole Foods, it's like a whole new world. She's seeing all these products for the first times. So I'm not saying try it, but you know, if you ever go down that route, I think there's some excitement that way as well.
Yeah, options open.
So you mentioned that you spent some time in Japan. How did that come about?
I went on an exchange program when I was in college. I was at school in New York and felt like I sort of needed maybe a break from the city and kind of picked Tokyo on a whim. I knew a little bit of Japanese from a year of language classes, and I really liked looking at Japanese fashion magazines. So thought, you know, Japan feels like maybe as far as I can get from New York, maybe geographically and sort of mentally. So ended up there for about a year. It was really a life-changing experience for me to be there. I was going to school, working in a restaurant. I was lucky enough to live pretty close to the center, you know, really nice neighborhood in Tokyo. So I, you know, could go everywhere by bicycle and just really had it was a very immersive experience, I'd say.
I was going to say, what was it like living in Japan as a picky eater? Had you transitioned out of your picky eaterhood at this point?
I was getting better, but I think that really did a lot for me, honestly, because, you know, and there's not a lot of space for picky eaters in Japan necessarily. And I think, you know, I was very conscious of etiquette and I didn't want to be rude. So if I would go somewhere, you know, I would share, you know, what my specific dietary restrictions were. But outside of that, I really felt it was important to eat everything that was given to me. So it really expanded what I was eating and enjoying in a big way and made me much more adventurous about food. I tried things like natto and like fermented soybeans that I'd never had before that were, you know, maybe a challenge at the start, but really learned to love them. So yeah, it was great for pushing my boundaries when it came to food.
Yeah, I bet it sounds like. Were you like surprising yourself, like that I actually am coming to like some of these things?
I don't think I was that conscious of it necessarily. I think it was just kind of, that was the environment that I was in and just really felt like I wanted to absorb as much as I possibly could. So every day was a real, very much a new experience there. And that was a piece of it for sure.
So Charles, you mentioned that you were at N Japanese Brasserie in New York. Now, what the heck led you to moving to New York and landing a job in a kitchen when it sounds like you weren't all that into it growing up?
Wanting to get away. You know, getting away from the city I grew up in, you know, I wasn't really heading in any direction. And I wasn't going to college. I was thinking about going to art school. But that's about it. And I just flew across the country. My brother was living there. But other than that, it was like no friends, by myself. In New York. But it was a great decision, you know, and it led me to...
Yeah.
like my first restaurant job, which I was like, okay, I could do this for a living sort of thing. So, and then pretty much after that, I was like, I'm going to open a restaurant, you know? So pretty quickly I knew that I was going to open a restaurant, maybe 2 years after that first restaurant job.
What about it was like, yes, I'm feeling this.
It was a very like family atmosphere. You know, the chefs were all from Japan and they took care of me. And we went out every night. I mean, every single night we went out. The cooking was really good. They were cooking things I grew up with. So, you know, I understood them and I saw somebody make them. And that was special to the restaurant.
So, Courtney, I understand that N is where you guys actually met. How did you get involved into the crazy New York restaurant scene once you came back from Japan?
So when I got back from Japan, I still had a year left of school. So just, you know, I was concerned that if I didn't find a way to use Japanese language in my day-to-day life, I would forget it. I had been living my life almost entirely in Japanese in Japan. And I thought I might want to be an interpreter or a translator. And I thought I should really try to find a way to keep using the language. Otherwise, I'm going to forget it. So there's a sake bar in the East Village in New York called Decibel, where I had been out a few times. And I just sort of called them up on a whim at the encouragement of a friend and was like, hey, you know, are you hiring? They ended up hiring me. I had zero qualifications to be serving sake. I don't think I was not 21 yet either. Like, there was a lot of problems with this whole situation. But it was a really special place to work. The sake, it's, you know, a legend. I think they've been open now 40 something years. It's an institution in New York. It's a great place to learn about sake as well, but it's also just kind of similar to what Charles is saying about N. You know, all of my coworkers were from Japan. You know, they didn't have their families with them in New York. So they sort of created this sort of restaurant family. So we spent a lot of time together with a lot of camaraderie, and it was really just kind of that element of restaurants that really kind of drew me to it. And after I graduated, I sort of thought about going in a few different directions. I ended up taking a job as doing some translating work for a newspaper and realized pretty quickly, like, 9 to 5 was not the game for me. And then when my old coworkers from the sake bar had been approached by someone to help open N, they knew the owner sort of socially, and she had asked them, would they come on board as part of the opening team? And they reached out to me to see if I would come help them with the opening. And it was a pretty easy decision to say yes. I think I was over office life at that point.
Yeah, 100%. There's nothing better than getting the right invitation when you're not feeling what you're doing in your current day-to-day. So completely resonate with that. Now, is it Decibel where you really got your, like, sake education?
It is, yeah. You know, it wasn't a formal education. There wasn't, you know, classes, but I don't know, maybe 60 something sakes open all by the glass. Lots of opportunity to taste. The bar closed at 4. We would sit around afterwards. Somebody would make a second late night family meal. We would have a sip of something, sometimes a couple sips of something, and got to kind of taste through everything and talk about it. And I had some coworkers there who were very, very talented and knowledgeable about sake too. And they were generous with their time and energy in educating me on it. So yeah, that was really kind of where I got the foundation for sake education, and how to serve it and how to talk to people about it too, was a big piece of it.
Yeah. Well, look, I think that myself and a lot of our listeners probably are not the most familiar with sake, so we're going to dive into that in just a little bit. But you mentioned that you ended up at N, and obviously, Charles, you were already there. I think you were already there, right? I want to hear how you two first started dating. Any me cute stories to share with the listeners?
You know, as Charles said, it was a very social environment. We would all go out after work every day. We actually were both part of the opening team. So we were there from day one together. We all used to just kind of hang out together after work. Charles had an apartment that was the closest, I think, to the restaurant. Most of us lived kind of far out in the outer boroughs, and he had a convenient location in kind of border of Chinatown.
Yeah, it was just the room with like a futon. And that's all it was. But everybody came to my place to have drinks. And, you know, I think there was a lot of Japanese people around us. And we were like the only kind of...
Yeah, we were two... there were a couple other Americans, but it was primarily Japanese who were the Americans in the room. Yeah, and it just, you know, I think it's, we started as friends and just kind of gradually turned into more.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's a great story too. You know, I was hoping for like a specific anecdote of like you spilling sake on him or something and needing to dab it up or something. But it's okay. You know, we'll go with that. So from N. Charles, I understand that you had your first chef gig at Macau Trading Company. And I'd love to know how sort of that came about and what that experience was like to really have your first, like, you know, head guy in the kitchen role.
Yeah. It came from a job I got from the restaurant I was working at, Chanterelle. The chef was like consulting on the restaurant and he asked me to just help him open it. But I was young. I was like 25 years old. You know, I worked 3 or 4 years in restaurants, so I didn't know what I was doing. So it's like it's a harsh lesson, you know? You have to know what you're doing. You have to be qualified for the job, or you just can't do it. It's just too much.
What were like some of the biggest sort of like rude awakenings you had in that role?
Everything. Everything, the business part of it, the managing part of it, setting everything up in the kitchen. You know, it was a restaurant that opened at 5 and it closed at 4 in the morning. So It was just a lot. And it was like a 150 seat restaurant on top. So it was just, it was too much.
And Courtney, what were you doing during this time while Charles was over at Macau Trading Company?
I was working, so I had been at N, and then we had a really interesting sake program at N that was run by one of my former coworkers at the sake bar. But I got really interested in wine while I was there. There was the opening manager had been doing the wine list, and then when he left, there was sort of a void, and nobody really wanted to do it. So I kind of volunteered to do it, knowing absolutely nothing about it, but thinking like, oh, this would be like a fun way to learn on the job. So I got very interested in wine while I was working there, and you know, the opportunities were limited. It's a Japanese restaurant. The sake program was really robust. There wasn't a ton of room for wine. So wanted to get a job where I could learn more about that. We did take a little break and went to France for a little bit and did some traveling to try to visit some wine regions. When I came back, I took a job at Tribeca Grill. So very close to where he was working at Macau, with this huge legendary wine cellar. I was working as a floor manager, so kind of only touching the wine program tangentially, but it was really incredible to be around these really amazing bottles that I probably would have never been exposed to otherwise. So I was there for a couple of years.
What was it like to go from the world of sake over to the world of wine?
I think I was pretty young and didn't like necessarily feel, was not as in tune to maybe the politics of both of them, because I think they do share that in terms of kind of how the industries are run. But, you know, why I think the sake industry in New York, I found it to be really very welcoming. It was very small. It was, you know, the average kind of guest or consumer is really looking for education. There's not a, you know, I would say in general, the American audience has kind of a baseline understanding of wine that perhaps they don't have for sake. It's really, you know, it's a lot of fun to get to work with sake because you often are dealing with kind of a blank slate and you can really get people to like give honest feedback on what they're tasting and enjoying. Wine I found was definitely a little bit more buttoned up, a little bit more connection based, I guess, or maybe I was again sort of naive to it because I had come from a great sake bar and had all these one friends who I thought of were my friends that were actually kind of powerful people in the industry there to help advocate for me. But wine was a little harder to kind of get a foot in the door, I would say, just due to the long history. But I think that's changing. And I do think the industry is becoming a lot more welcoming and more open to new voices and new perspectives than perhaps it was back then.
Do you think that the like natural wine, natty wine movement has something to do with that? Or is that sort of the area that's now kind of like looked down upon and it's kind of united everybody else in the wine world against it?
You know, I think it's interesting. I do think it's helped in a lot of ways. I think it helped, you know, in terms of being able to afford thing, you know, I think that a lot of, you know, natural wine, the cost of entry can be a little bit lower than perhaps it was when it was, you know, more about how many Grand Cru Burgundies had you tasted, or, you know, how much, you know, sort of higher end, you know, it was sort of more centered around high end wine. I do think there's still gatekeeping around natural wine too, perhaps in a different way. That's, you know, I think maybe that's just human nature. We're always going to do that. But I think, I do think it has helped to sort of democratize it in a way, but I think the industry still has some work to do in terms of becoming a little bit more inclusive and hearing other voices and allowing for exposure to all types of people. I think there's still some work to be done there, but I do think it has improved since I started out.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, becoming more inclusive and inviting more voices sounds like something that can be said of a lot of industries out there. So I think you're definitely onto something, but sounds like you both had a lot of good stuff happening in New York. How did you guys decide to pick up and move across the country back to Los Angeles?
To open a restaurant. That was the goal. I was going to go work at the French Laundry. I didn't get a job there. So then I flew out to Bouchon in Beverly Hills. They were going to open one. So I was like, I'm going to work there while trying to open a restaurant. So really the reason was to open a restaurant. We thought it was cheaper.
Yeah, back then, this was 2010. And I think, you know, the real estate world has seen has changed in LA since then, the past 14 years. But back then, it felt a little bit more feasible to open in LA than it did in New York, just the cost to open it. I don't know if that's true anymore.
Yeah, that's not true anymore.
But back then, maybe slightly easier.
So if you were doing it today, what would you be? Would you be like opening a izakaya in Pittsburgh or something?
Maybe. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. I think it's rough out there right now. The real estate landscape is not friendly. It's for sure.
So you moved out here. You got great jobs in the restaurant industry, but all the while you're thinking about, when are we going to open our own place? Was the plan at the time to open an izakaya, or did you have other things in mind?
We first thought we were going to open a French restaurant, actually. We had like a whole business plan and menu and everything kind of picked out for it. And it sort of evolved gradually into a Japanese concept. I think there were a few different kind of inflection points where we thought maybe it would make more sense. But I think really we kind of looked around and, you know, New York had, when we were living there, had this really like energetic Japanese restaurant scene, like this izakaya scene that were open really late and tons of sake and beer and lots of little things to snack on. Yeah. And I feel like when we came to LA, there was, but there wasn't, I think maybe not, it was felt different than it did in New York. I think we felt like we had maybe something we could contribute to it. Maybe show, I think a lot of the restaurants that were in LA at the time were sort of reflecting perhaps an older vision of an izakaya. And I thought, could we show maybe a more modern, updated version, things we saw in Japan that were very seasonal and kind of more in acknowledging the fact that we were in LA, using local ingredients, not necessarily being rigid to sort of a Japanese formula, but sort of the spirit of an izakaya, but through an LA lens, I think was kind of.
Yeah, I think so many places are doing that now. It's all changing, so it's cool.
Did you have any hesitations about the concept? Or like, you know, because I remember when I moved to Los Angeles, this was a while ago, well before Tsubaki opened, but I remember I lived in West LA, that sort of like unincorporated, you know, assortment of blocks that's between, you know, Brentwood and Santa Monica and whatnot. And there was an izakaya on Santa Monica Boulevard. And I just remember they needed to have a sign outside the door that said there's no sushi sold here, basically. Like, because like, I think they probably had a lot of folks going in there asking them, you know, hey, where's the sushi? You know, this is a Japanese restaurant. I think obviously by 2013, that had probably shifted a little bit, and definitely by the time Tsubaki opened. But like, did you face any sort of resistance to the concept or any sort of challenges? Like, hey, you might want to think about like doing things a little bit differently.
Yeah, I think, you know, the restaurant that where Tsubaki is located, it had been a Japanese restaurant before us. They did a lot of skewers, but they also it's the same owner as Silver Lake Ramen. So they had like a pretty big following for their ramen. I think we get a little bit of a few questions about sushi, but we got a lot of people coming in. Why don't you have ramen? Maybe that was due to, you know, 2017, I think, was kind of peak ramen boom in LA. So I think maybe that a little bit more than sushi we heard.
People still ask me, do you have sushi?
Yeah. Once in a while people come in and they'll make a reservation and come in and sit down and look at the menu and be like, well, where are your rolls?
The dentist just asked me.
it does still happen. Yeah. But I think for us, it was more than that. I think people at that point, we opened in 2017. I think a lot of people coming to see us, I should say, had an idea of what an izakaya was. But I think there was a conception of an izakaya was supposed to be cheap. It was supposed to be really cheap skewers, pitchers of beer. So I think people were sort of confused by our menu because, you know, it wasn't dollar skewers. It wasn't $10 pitchers. It was, you know, really sort of more of a sort of ingredient driven, craft sake driven experience. So I think that was where there was some friction for us at the beginning, more necessarily than people thinking we were a sushi restaurant. Although that was a piece of it for sure.
And I realize you guys just celebrated 7 years open at Tsubaki. So, you know, congratulations on that. But when you were first devising the menu over there, Charles, for the food menu, what was your inspiration? What were your thoughts in terms of like, this is what I want to deliver?
Designing the menu, you know, I wanted to do something fried, like a croquette or tempura. You know, I always wanted to have some sort of sliced fish. And then the grill section kind of went from chicken to pork belly to a lot of things like the fish collar. But I wanted to be like a Japanese izakaya, you know, where like a little more care into everything and, you know, elevated drinks. And yeah, that's how I kind of designed the menu for it to be very simple, you know? And then when we started doing farmers market ingredients, you know, we just changed with the season. You know, we would change the tempura, or we would change the cold vegetable dish, or we would change the salad. And then it kind of, it grew, got better.
We do a lot of things off a little kind of 5-foot charcoal grill, which, you know, the logistics do determine a lot of how the menu, I think, came to be, because it's a small space back there for sure. Limited storage and limited room to move around.
Yeah, what we could get in, not do too much to, and cook.
Yeah, that makes sense. It sounds like also a big consideration here was how everything would go together with the drink portion. And that's really, you know, what I'm interested in learning on that front is, you know, when you were opening Tsubaki, what was the sake culture in Los Angeles like, Courtney? And sort of how did you think about, okay, I want to, what do I want to accomplish here? And how do I approach it in a way that's, yes, going to do what I want to do and accomplish what I want to accomplish, but also going to like resonate with where Los Angeles is right now in terms of its relationship to sake?
Yeah, it's, you know, honestly, I was really not in the sake scene in LA very much. Before we opened, I was working in wine. I didn't know anybody really in the sake side of things. So it's really hard for me to speak to what was happening. You know, I would know when I would go out to restaurants, there was very good sake on a lot of menus, but my perception was that it was often the same brands over and over again. You know, very good, very well-made quality sake, but perhaps there was it was sort of monotonous in terms of you would sort of see the same big names everywhere. So when we were opening, you know, I had a couple of different goals. One was to serve maybe lesser known sakes from family run breweries that were maybe doing things in a special way, whatever that means. You know, maybe that's unique, specific to each brewery, but doing something special to demonstrate what a broad category sake is in terms of flavor. I think sometimes I think sometimes you can see sort of only a narrow band of the spectrum represented on a sake list, where it's very clean, crisp, kind of that sort of modern style. But perhaps, you know, I thought, can we show the sort of the broad range from the very, very savory and earthy all the way to the like spritzy and effervescent and sort of juicy, fruity side, aged sake, barrel, sake done in barrel, just sort of show that it's a category worth exploring. I think sometimes it, at least at that time, perhaps was considered to be less than wine in terms of the amount of like, you know, the flavor and aroma that it could express. So wanted to show it off, and then to also make it accessible and fun. I think there's an intimidation factor with sake when you look at a list and it's just a bunch of Japanese words, and if you have no context for them, how are you supposed to choose something that you're going to like? So, you know, we write descriptions for all of our sakes on the list that are meant to sort of be hopefully like easy to read and easy to understand, not, you know, sort of fancy tasting notes, but hopefully flavors that are familiar to most people. Because the goal is to drink something delicious. It shouldn't be scary. It shouldn't be, you know, a stressful moment. But I do think that moment of ordering and glass of sake in a restaurant can be kind of high stress or high anxiety. So how do we make that? How do we diffuse that? How do we make it fun and you know, a joyful, delicious thing?
I love that. I think that the, you know, the thought put into sort of like the user experience is so critical. Like, as you said, it can be super intimidating, and there's nothing worse than when like a sommelier, and this is with wine, not with sake, like comes up to you and is like asking you what you want for wine, and you have absolutely no idea. It's almost like humiliating, you know?
Yeah,
it's like you feel like embarrassed, put on the spot. Exactly. Yeah. It's stressful.
Yeah.
So, you know, for people who haven't had as much experience with sake and who want to go to Tsubaki and like, or Ototo and want to like have a fun first experience, how would you sort of like explain quote unquote sake to them and sort of like recommend they set out on their first time experience?
I think one of the hardest pieces at the beginning is being able to articulate what you like, to say, these are the flavors that I like. This is the profile that I like. You know, there's lots of vocabulary around sake. There's words to describe how much the rice has been polished or how the yeast starter gets made or whether it's pasteurized or not. And those are really helpful, but I always think of those as sort of stage two. But first we have to identify what somebody likes. So usually that's the first question I ask is like, what, you know, give me a couple words. Like, and they don't have to be like sake words. They can just be like, you know, I like tropical flavors. I like, I want something breezy. I like, you know, it's a warm day. I want something refreshing. Like all of these things are helpful. I like something really like deep, or I like to drink really full bodied red wine. Like that helps too. And then once we can start tasting things, you know, and saying, and if you're able to identify, I like this glass. Okay. What do I like about it? And then putting words to that, that is what you can really build on. So then your next experience, you can come in and I love the guests who take a picture of what they liked and they can show us, hey, last time I was here, I had this bottle. Do you have anything similar? And then we can kind of grow it from here. But I think people get stuck in feeling like they need to be able, like they don't have the words to describe what they're looking for. And I think a big part of our job is to try to help give them that vocabulary to talk about it. Without it being, you know, without feeling like they have to give like a tasting note out of a wine, you know, that a wine critic would give, but just like any word, you know, like anything is really, really helpful for us. And then let us try to sort of piece that together.
Yeah. So you're telling me I don't need to be coming in and be able to describe the mouthfeel of what I want in order to have a good time? Good.
I hope not.
So if I like a crisp, dry lager, what would you recommend for me sake wise?
I think it's, you know, I would recommend, honestly, a style of sake called Honjozo that is often much maligned in sake. It's a style of sake that has a little bit of brewer's alcohol added to it. So it does not, it has distilled alcohol added. It is not a higher ABV because most sake gets diluted with water anyway. But what that alcohol does is it helps to lift aromatics. It helps to make the sake drink a little bit drier and crisper and lighter. So often honjozos are really refreshing, crisp, clean, lightly aromatic styles that are perfect for the weather in LA, like 9 months, maybe not today, but like 9 months out of the year. When people want something really refreshing, it can be a really great place to start. You know, it's one, I have a couple of pet projects with sake. One of them is getting people to embrace the alcohol added style because I think it gets a bad rap. But that would be a starting place, I think, would be to try some of those. They're like really just like bright and refreshing and sessionable. And I love them as a category.
And what would you recommend I pair with that food wise?
I would put something fried and crunchy and a little salty together with it. We have right now on the menu at Ototo these little soft shell shrimp from Transparency. They're a sustainable kind of aquaculture farm out in Downey, so local to us. And they raise just specifically for us these really little shrimp that they call popcorn shrimp, right? I think that's what they call
them. That's what they're calling them now.
but we just fry them whole. They're in soft shell, so you can eat the shell with the head on, and we do a little spicy sancho furikake on top, and they're just like the perfect bar snack. And I think about, you know, you're drinking a beer, you're eating like salted peanuts or some popcorn, something crispy and salty. I think these are the perfect kind of stand-in for that. So that's where I would go.
That sounds absolutely delicious. I'm getting hungry right now. Let's rewind a little bit to the opening of Tsubaki, those like first year or so. I remember I actually lived right down the street. You know where like Little Joy is on the corner?
Yeah.
I lived right up that street, and I actually remember I went to Tsubaki like 3 or 4 months after it opened. I lived so close that actually I got stood up for dinner and I was able to call my roommate and be like, hey, bro, come on over. We're having dinner. That's how close I lived. But what were those first few months like in terms of reception? Was it all of a sudden? I remember it being pretty like buzzy and hot, but what did it feel like from the inside?
It was really hard.
Yeah, it was very hard. It was very slow. And it just gradually got bigger and bigger, you know, and more filled up.
I feel like that the first few months we really struggled, though. I think that we got a little bit of press at the opening and then sort of nothing for a really long time. And I think the reason we were able to survive is the neighborhood really embraced us, which was great. We saw a lot of the same faces every day. A lot of people said they would walk to us. We were like the Sunday night dinner spot for a lot of the families in the area. But it was really hard. And I think we were still maybe trying to figure out exactly what our identity was, because I think it was confusing to people. Like, we're Japanese, but the dishes are not all very, they didn't always read or Japanese. And I think it was, we were still kind of trying to figure out our identity for the beginning, for that first part. But I think, you know, I don't think back fondly on how slow we were, but I think it gave us the opportunity to really like play with the menu and play with different things and sort of the freedom to sort of try things out, see what worked, see what didn't, because there wasn't a spotlight on us maybe in the beginning. We sort of felt like we were just sort of under the radar for quite a long time. Until about a year and a half in, we got an LA Weekly review, and then we got an LA Times review, and then that sort of changed things. And I think we were put on the radar for more people. But yeah, those first ones were tough for sure.
Was the LA Times review, was it Bill Addison already, or was it still Jonathan Gold at the time?
It was Patricia, actually, who reviewed
Patricia,
us.
She's okay.
No longer. Yeah, and it was a great review. Jonathan Gold had come in a couple times, actually, and I think in retrospect, he was preparing a review, and it was right before he passed away, so that review never ran. But he did come in a few times, and he was lovely, and he drank very good sake. He had very specific taste in sake, and I was pouring a glass for him, and he told me this very unique sake called Cowboy, and he said, I always keep a bottle of Cowboy in my fridge, and I thought that was cool to hear.
Badass.
But no, he was great, and then, you know, we've always been sad we never got to see what he would have written, but thankfully someone else at the time, you know, Patricia at the Times did a really great job for us, so we were really happy to see that, and it really made a difference for us.
So you can, like, literally trace a bump in business to, like, when you started getting those reviews?
Yeah, the first thing that really helped was we were on an episode of Migrant Kitchen, it's a series that Life and Time does about different sort of immigrant groups in LA. And they did an episode on Japanese people in LA and Japanese Americans. So they included us in that. And I remember we opened in February, and it was that episode ran the weekend of Thanksgiving. And the week after, we saw especially a lot of like older Japanese Americans coming in to see us, which was very cool. And we saw an immediate shift in sort of our reservations in terms of volume right away after that aired. So I do every time I see the folks from Life and Time, I thank them for saving our restaurant, because I do think they did. And then I think after that, it was the print reviews really went a long way. So yeah, kind of a combination.
I often wonder, like, how much do those kinds of things really matter. I think about that, especially with respect to, like, you know, influencer posts and stuff like that. But I'm curious, what did the older Japanese Americans think when they came into the restaurant? Because you said, you know, your restaurant is not traditional. You have like sort of like different things on the menu. Were there any sort of like side eyes thrown in there? Or was it pretty embracing of your guys' style?
I feel like everybody really embraced it. I really met a lot of lovely people in that wave of guests coming in. A lot of them still come see us today. I think a lot of our guests wanted to meet Charles, if you remember. A lot of people asking to come back to the kitchen and meet him. Everybody who came in at that point was really open to what we were doing. And I think when we could sort of say, like, hey, this is a Japanese American restaurant. This is not a Japanese restaurant, but we live in the US, we're both American. I think that when people could start to see it through that lens, it really kind of helped them to understand what we were trying to do. I don't know if you agree.
Yeah, I think it's a Japanese restaurant too, but But yeah, a lot of Japanese chefs, you know, they come to our restaurant, and especially like sushi chefs, you know, they eat sushi all the time. They want to eat something different.
How did Ototo come about? At what point were you like, okay, we're ready to do something else?
Yeah, it was like the week after we opened Tsubaki, the landlord called us and was like, hey, the hair salon next door isn't leaving. Do you want to take over the space? And I think we were both just sort of in the pre-opening, like sleep deprived, anxiety, like whirlwind, and just said yes, like without any concept of what we were going to do. But I think we had realized like, hey, this space is really small that we're in right now. And I think we thought like, no matter what, it'll be better to have a little more space, no concept whatsoever for it. And just sort of signed the lease and figured it out from there. It kind of was we did things sort of backwards. But we realized, you know, we first thought maybe we would do like a lunch concept, right?
It was going to be a sandwich concept.
Sandwiches.
Oh, really?
It was all over the place. But I think we realized that Tsubaki, you know, it's a small restaurant. We had 33 seats. If tables don't turn exactly the way they need to, there can be very long, you know, we could run very behind on reservations if one party, you know, happens to be really enjoying themselves and spend an extra 20 minutes at the table over dessert. You know, all of a sudden we're backed up for, you know, for the next two turns, and we had nowhere for anybody to wait. We would have people very upset because, you know, they have to stand outside. We thought, what if we had a bar next door where people could go and hang out, and we could provide a seat and something, a snack, something to sip on. And then as time went on, we also realized there was this really strong appetite for sake in LA. People seemed to be really, it seemed to really be resonating. People wanted, asking for all sorts of weird things. You know, they wanted to try the weird stuff, the interesting stuff, the whole spectrum. And we thought, you know, maybe a sake bar could make sense. Maybe there is room to do something that's really sake focused. So it was sort of driven by our experiences at Tsubaki, I think, of seeing like what is the public looking for, what is our audience looking for, plus solving some internal logistical problems too, sort of a combination.
Yeah. I love that. You guys kind of just like got an opportunity. You were like, we're just going to say yes to this and it'll reveal to us what it wants to be. It's very like, you know, millennial new agey of you. I love that. So, okay. For folks who are thinking about like Ototo and Tsubaki and have a hard time distinguishing between the two menus, you know, like food wise, Charles, what would you say sort of like distinguishes the food between Tsubaki and Ototo?
I think the main part of Tsubaki is the grill, you know, the yakitori, the grilled fish, the grilled pork. And I think Ototo is more like on the smaller side plates. And we do a lot of like what we want to do. It's kind of, we have pasta dishes, we will do a French dish. So it's more plateful. And Ototo also has the raw bar, you know, so oysters, scallops, crab, it's just part of the menu we've been doing. So,
yeah, I love your katsu sando that you've done there. I've eaten a lot of sandwiches. Last year, I actually traveled the city eating 100 different iconic sandwiches in 365 days. So I've had a few other versions, but yours is definitely up there. Can you talk me through that sandwich real quick and for listeners who have never had it?
Yeah, so it's basically Japanese milk bread. So it's like, it's Wonder Bread, kind of Japanese Wonder Bread. And we do this to order, you know, we bread the chicken thighs and panko, and there's a little bit of like tonkatsu sauce, which is Japanese barbecue sauce, and then shredded lettuce, pickled jalapenos, and some Cuban mayo, and we cut the crust off and cut it in half, and that's it.
You know, it's so weird to say, but it's the shredded lettuce for me. It's just like, it's like that, it's that fresh texture and just sort of like that thing that like adds a different layer. I absolutely love it. So folks, if you haven't had it, please head over to Ototo and try it. And if you don't like it, you can get mad at me, not at Charles. And I do want to ask though, obviously, like both Tsubaki and Ototo have received some really amazing accolades over the years. You know, just last year, you got the James Beard Award for Outstanding Wine or Other Beverages Program. How does all of that acclaim feel to you guys? Like, how does it feel to like look at what you've created, stand back and be like, hey, this is ours. We earned this.
I think it's always exciting. You know, we did work really hard. Our team also works really hard. I really think of these as team efforts. You know, there's no restaurant without all the other people showing up every day and working with us. And I think, you know, we try to use it as a, or at least for me personally, I can only speak for myself, to try to keep going, you know, keep going. Like it's a, it can sometimes be an industry that's a little bit thankless. It can be, you know, there's a grind to it, like there are for lots of industries. So it's nice to take a moment to kind of reflect on like, yeah, like this is resonating with people. This is, you know, this is, there is something meaningful here, but to use it as a, you know, a push to kind of keep going and inspire, you know, inspire new things and, you know, what can we do next? Like we've come this far, but we don't want to stop here. We want to build on it and keep doing more. You know, it's, but it's more than anything else, I think it's just so great for our team. I think for them to feel recognized and for them to feel like what they're doing has, you know, is being seen, I think, goes a really, really long way. I think we really felt that after the award this past year of just how, what it did for kind of our team and their morale and their culture.
Charles, anything to add?
No, I just feel the same way, sort of just to grow, you know, and these things happen and you could do other projects and grow your team.
I think the sake industry is one that also has been in trouble for a very long time. You know, in Japan, it's as an industry domestically, it's struggling. These are oftentimes tiny breweries run by a husband and wife, or maybe their kids, and they're very much physical jobs and very intense labors of love that don't always get a lot of respect and recognition. So I think for the sake industry, also to see that something, you know, and this institution like James Beard would recognize sake, I think was really meaningful for me also to see that, you know, sake sort of getting the love that I feel like it's deserved for a long time and getting taken seriously and respect in sort of the wider world of beverages was really, really meaningful. So.
I don't know too much about that. What's going on with sake in Japan? Why is it struggling?
It's just not, you know, the cool drink. It's you know, young people aren't really drinking it. It's, you know, people there, either young people tend to drink more wine or beer, shochu cocktail, you know, huge cocktail culture in Japan. And sake is kind of like grandpa's drink, you know, it isn't really like what kids want. And it's also confusing for Japanese people too. Like it's, you know, we think that, you know, as English speakers that perhaps that's why we're not able to understand these labels, but it's confusing for people in Japan too, to be able to like know what they want and get what they want. It's much easier to have a beer. So I think that's a piece of it. I think also, you know, these breweries are usually passed down from generation to generation. And sometimes the younger generation doesn't want to live out in the middle of the country where the sake is being made and dedicate their life to it. So a lot of breweries are closing. So a lot of the brewers I talk to are really looking towards the international market as a place of growth for sake. You know, so when brewers come to Ototo and they're like, wow, look at all these Americans drinking sake. I think, you know, that really means a lot to me. They're often really surprised. Like, look at these like young people, in LA drinking sake. Cause I don't think, you know, in Japan, I think it is struggling as a category to kind of make inroads with the young generation. So it was really gratifying to be able to see it kind of in this bigger stage as a beverage, that, you know, hopefully now, you know, it's growing in the US. I just hope it continues to do so.
Have they made sake hard seltzers? I feel like that's always like the liquor. That's always like, you know, like liquor brand's first attempt to try to reach out to younger consumers.
There's shochu, there's chuhai, canned chuhai that are kind of like the White Claw of Japanese canned alcoholic drinks. I haven't seen it with sake yet, although there is a big push for sparkling sake. So maybe I think that is, it might not be too far away that we start to see it.
They probably have it.
Yeah. Well, if it doesn't exist, I'm 100% taking credit for it. To make no mistake about that. Look, you know, you mentioned how the many accolades and the awards have been inspiration for continuing to grow and to try new things. You know, you recently announced your new project, Camellia, in the Arts District. I understand there's not a lot that you can say about it, but in general, what can folks look forward to?
You know, I think we're coming right back around to that French restaurant that we had originally conceived that, you know, was kind of put on the back burner when we opened Tsubaki. I think both of us have a love for French cuisine and French wine. Charles cooked at Chanterelle in New York for many years, cooked at Bouchon here in LA. So, but I don't think we wanted to do a straight up French restaurant. I think this is sort of, you know, if anyone has ever eaten French food in Tokyo, it's some of the best outside of France. And it's a little bit different. It's, you know, often can be a little lighter, a little, you know, Japanese flavors incorporated into the structure of a French meal. So I think we're hoping to bring that to LA, that sort of experience.
Bistro. It's going to be a Japanese French bistro.
That's awesome. That's really cool. I mean, I feel like folks are getting used to this idea of like adopting or learning about flavors from, you know, cultures like Italian cuisines, but cooked through like a Japanese lens. Like, for example, with Pizzeria Say over in Beverlywood. But I don't think anything like that exists in Los Angeles. So I'm really excited about it personally, and I'm sure many of our listeners will share that sentiment. Look, you've been very generous with your time here today, and I just want to thank you for joining us. But I just want to, before I let you go, ask you both, when you look back on your journey and when you reflect on it as a whole, what are you most proud of? And let's maybe start with you, Courtney, when you reflect back on, you know, this Long Island kid who was really picky with her food. What are you most proud of that you've accomplished?
This is a big question. I hope it doesn't sound cliche, but I really do feel proud of the team that we've built. I think I think a restaurant really is, you know, the sum of all these people kind of coming together, working together. And I think that's what resonated with me when I first got into the industry. I don't think I would have stayed in restaurants or hospitality if I hadn't experienced that. So when I can take a step back and look at our team, you know, my team members who 2 years ago didn't know what a junmai sake was, and now they're at the table explaining the nuances of muroka namagenshu to a guest, or they're working together to create a new dish, or they're brainstorming, hey, we should do this cocktail. We should do this thing differently. I feel really proud of that, of sort of having kind of been able to build this team together. You know, it's not perfect. It's a collection of human beings, and it's hard every day, but I really do. That's the piece that really amazes me when I take a step back and look at it is the people together we're working together with.
That's awesome. Charles, how about you? You've come a long way from Mulberry Street Pizza.
I think it's the employing people, and opening a business is a big part, big one. I think it's contributing to society, and it feels great. And that's it.
Hey, I think that's great. Hey, more than I do. I employ nobody, and I'm not sure how I contribute to society. So I think that's great. And if people are looking for you guys, where can they find you online? Obviously, they can find you in Echo Park and soon in the Arts District in person. But how about online?
Instagram is the best way to keep up with what we're doing. So at @tsubakiLA or at @ototo.la are the best places to know what we've got going on. We have a mailing list. You can sign up on the tsubakiLA.com website as well.
Well, Charles, Courtney, thank you for joining us, and congratulations on all your success.
Thank you for having us.
It was fun.
Thanks to Courtney and Charles for joining us on the podcast today. Thanks, dear listener, to you for listening to this episode of the LA Food Podcast. If you like what you heard today, please go to wherever you listen to podcasts, leave us a rating, a review, subscribe. Seriously, all that stuff really helps us make our way up the charts on both Spotify and Apple. We'll be back with another epic episode next week, but if you're looking for me in the meantime, you can find me at the LA Countdown on Instagram, TikTok, and Threads. That's TheLaCountdown. You can also find us on YouTube at the LA Countdown. That's at TheLaCountdown. And you can also find us on Instagram at LA Food Pod. That's LAFOOD POD.